This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
I'm Paul Kennedy with the ideas of Leonore Tiefer. Leonore Tiefer has declared war on pharmasex. The pioneering sexologist thinks the pharmaceutical industry is reshaping the way we think about our bodies and how we practice sex. Leonore Tiefer believes if men learned how to dance and diaper babies, not at the same time, of course, maybe we wouldn't need Viagra. In other words, sex involves two people. It's not about obsessing over how the equipment works. Leonore Tiefer is smart, funny, controversial. A feminist who calls herself a revolutionary on behalf of sex. In her landmark book, Sex is Not a Natural Act, and other essays, Leonore Tiefer describes the consequences of living in a hyper-sexualized culture. Constant images of sex bombard and numb us. Plastic surgery creates the improved or perfect body. Drugs can help us perform. And this is killing sexual creativity. Leonore Tiefer reminds us that we're diverse creatures, shaped by cultural, historical, social, and individual forces, a recurring theme in her collection of essays.
A kiss is not a kiss in this perspective. Your orgasm is not the same as George Washington's. Premarital sex in Peru is not premarital sex in Peoria. Abortion in Rome at the time of Caesar is not abortion in Rome at the time of John Paul II. All of these actions remain to be defined by individual experience within one's period and place.
Leonore Tiefer believes that as a culture, we're losing sight of this richness and diversity, and an increasing homogeneity is creating an epidemic of insecurity around sex and our bodies. A Jewish sexologist from the Bronx, Leonore Tiefer is clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine. She lectures around the world and still maintains a private practice in sex therapy in Manhattan. Ideas producer Mary O'Connell sat down to speak with Leonore Tiefer about sex.
Now, in your book, Sex is Not a Natural Act, and other essays, you talk about expectations. You talk about a lot of anxiety that's created by the importance of sex. But first of all, I want to ask you about the title.
Sex is Not a Natural Act?
Yes.
Well, it really sums up my most profound insight and the message that I want to get across. Obviously, it's sort of funny and provocative, but the point is that people rely on the assumed naturalness of sexuality, like dying people hanging on to the side of a sinking ship. I mean, it's kind of a desperate conviction rather than anything that they've arrived at as the result of observation or reflection. My belief is that if you keep your eyes open and if you reflect about things, you'll realize that sex isn't natural at all, that it has a whole lot to do with culture and media and previous experience and expectations and so on. So I thought that Sex is Not a Natural Act really, it kind of summarizes this counterintuitive notion that is at the heart of my philosophy and my therapy and my research.
Do we think that everyone else is having more sex than we are? I mean, what is our idea about ourselves and our sexuality and others?
I feel quite certain that 200 or 300 years ago, much less 500 or 1,000 years ago, nobody could care less about how much sex other people were having. It was not a priority. But in the last 50 years or so, increasingly so, maybe even escalating over the last 10 or 15 or 20 years, sex has become so much a measure of one's worth in a relationship and in society that adequacy and frequency and all of these things have taken on great meaning. I think that's becoming more true for men, I have to say. I see a lot of men in my practice who are feeling pressured to have sex to prove that they're okay.
Feeling pressure from?
Peers, peer pressure, and, internalized. You internalize these norms. I think of the case I saw last night, 24-year-old guy, and he's only had 3 partners, and he's absolutely convinced that he's, like, so far behind his peers. It's tragic.
And he's deeply troubled by this.
He's deeply troubled. Now, all of these things fall on fertile ground. You know, it's the anxious person, the obsessional person, the perfectionistic person, and so on. You know, people don't think that these things affect them.
Mm-hmm.
So nowadays, it's important people feel that they have a sense of whether they're normal, whether they're in the ballpark. On the cover of every magazine, you know, how to have sex 25 ways, how to keep your guy, how to look good, you know, liposuction. And you can't sort of go 2 steps without some sexual image crossing your path.
Well, do you think we live in a hypersexualized culture in terms of the imagery? In terms of?
Is there a stronger word than hypersexualized?
I don't know.
Yeah, out of control, over the top, ridiculously so, yes. So that people are being taught to be highly desirous. And whatever desire people used to have, which was kind of a, you know, on again, off again thing and depended a lot on the novelty of a relationship or personality or previous experience, or was just kind of people are come out of the egg different in terms of their interest in sexuality. There was a huge amount of variation. That variation is being eliminated as a kind of standardized image is promoted that says do it a lot, want it a lot, enjoy it a lot, flaunt it a lot, brag about it a lot, and that's this inexhaustibility thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've written that the word impotent was rarely mentioned in the psychological literature for decades, like it didn't even exist, but that this started to change by the 1980s with the emergence of what some call phallocentrism. What does this mean?
I think the phallocentrism of our time is symbolized perhaps best by the explosion around Viagra. Mm-hmm. I think that the advertising campaign promoted by Pfizer and the other companies now that there are other drugs out there on the market, and Viagra is not all by its lonesome anymore, but all of the advertising campaigns have promoted the idea that the success of erection has become wildly overstated as the centerpiece and sine qua non of a successful sexual experience and sexual life, and everything else just kind of comes along automatically. There's never any talk about tenderness or romance or know what you're doing or not all women like a hard penis or this. I mean, all of that is completely invisible.
And what does this do to the partner? And we're talking heterosexually here, to the woman. I'm just wondering on a psychological level.
Well, I'll tell you, I really would like to see a lot of research on this. Of course, the companies that fuel the research on Viagra and the other drugs are not very interested in finding out any bad news. So there's very little research. Mm-hmm. But what limited research there is, and, you know, there's maybe 4 or 5 studies I know from New Zealand and Australia in particular, 2 or 3 from the U.S., a couple from England. But it's consistent in saying that women's experiences are diverse. Mm-hmm. Some women are thrilled to bits, some women are horrified, disgusted, and turned off. And some women are tolerant, and some women are angry, and some women are just patient. Mm-hmm. If those relationships were humdrum or uncommunicative or boring or painful or coercive or whatever, they're probably going to be the same way with the drug as without the drug. If, on the other hand, the relationships were more mutual and inventive and creative and, you know, had some energy and effort in them, then they'll kind of incorporate drugs in the same way they might incorporate a vibrator or incorporate memories or incorporate a glass of wine or incorporate whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, those are the relationships that probably don't even need the drugs.
I guess is there something implicit with the use of Viagra that it will improve other areas of the relationship as well?
I think it's implied.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the first set of ads that came out in 1998 showed a couple dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wearing high heels, and she had a really, nice little dress, and she had a big smile on her face, and they were dancing. Well, dancing is, I mean, how many women have desperately tried to get their husband to go dancing, and, like, the impression was, hey, you know, you give him this pill, and he'll want to go dancing. So,
right.
You know, not only was the implication that the drug would restore the choreography of their sex life,
mm-hmm.
but it would make him a more romantic person also. Well, you know, show me the evidence for that.
Right.
The point is, we all change our physiology month to month, year to year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things ache, they break, you know, you have a cold, the kid is sick, you get poor, you get rich. I mean, life, you change.
Mm-hmm.
And so your sexual experience changes along with it. And if you go through a period of time where you can't perform the intercourse
mm-hmm.
in the usual way, well, you do something else and enjoy that. I mean, it's about pleasure. You know, that's a thing that totally blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And to get back to phallocentrism, I mean, I do think that this is a critical issue. And that is that Viagra is clearly linked to vaginal intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I was concerned a lot about, and there again is very limited research on this, but that suggests that there's changes in foreplay as a result of taking these drugs. It cost me $10. You know, I want to get my money's worth here. Let us not fool around. Let's get right to it.
Right.
We are nothing but physicality. I mean, I'm sitting here in a chair. It's the physical me. I don't exist, you know, as some kind of floating spiritual essence.
Well, you do in radio, though.
Let's hear it for radio. I don't think people take the Viagra as part of the fun part of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think they take the Viagra as insurance against failure. And I've spilled so much blood and so much ink trying to explore how it is that people are more willing to adopt a physical explanation for things than a psychological or social or cultural or interpersonal one. It's amazing. People would rather have something broken. You know, they'd rather have low hormones, or they'd rather have a vascular blockage, or than be thought of as anxious. I mean, people want to think of themselves in a way that I find astonishing, as kind of robotic. But I know that treating something that's psychological is not that difficult. It's not that difficult, and it's even fun. It's about learning. It's about talking. It's about thinking about things in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not insoluble. Somehow, a lot of the people sort of behind the engine of Viagra have come out and said, well, you know, they, the psychologists, the psychotherapists, they haven't been able to solve this for hundreds and thousands and millions of years. Thank God we've got pills now.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't true. I mean, I've been treating people with all kinds of sexual problems for decades, and I know lots and lots and lots of other people who've also been treating couples and individuals in a psychological way with success.
Mm-hmm.
But the rap, the rhetoric, the myth is that a psychological problem is demeaning, it's insoluble.
It's weak.
It's weak. My feeling is exactly the opposite. Pills? Ay, ay, ay. Pills have side effects. Pills are dangerous. Pills interact with other pills. Pills cost money. You have to remember to take them. Whereas your attitudes you have with you all the time. But, you know, we've been talking about, you know, biology versus psychology. And I would like us just to make sure that we add to that picture social factors, because I really believe that social factors cause more sexual problems than either psychological or biological ones.
Social factors like what?
Social factors like changing expectations, for example. I think changing expectations and the escalation of expectations to the point, you know, where it's very easy to fail, quote unquote. If you have to have an orgasm every single time you have sexual relations, it's going to be hard to accomplish that because we're all supposed to be robots and it's all supposed to be biological and automatic. These expectations are part of the culture now. So I feel like social factors, let's put in there the lack of sex education, the lack of comfort in talking about sex, the fact that it's still embarrassing for a lot of people to talk about it, that they lack a diverse vocabulary for expressing how they feel, what they want. That's a lot of what we do in sex therapy, I'll say. You know, people come in, they're practically tongue-tied. I saw a guy the other night. He must have said, I never thought of it, 150 times. I would say, how did you feel about that? Why did you want that? Why did you say that to her? You know, why? How often do you want to have sex? Well, I'd like to have sex every day. Why? Long pause. What do you mean, why? I never thought of it. It would be that kind of thing. Say, well, you know, think about it now. Why? Well, everybody wants to, don't they? Well, maybe everybody does, but tell me why you do. Long pause. I never thought about it. So, I mean, there's so many ways in which people lack comfort in the topic and lack of vocabulary for dealing with the topic, and I see that as a social problem.
Right. Now, you are today, of course, you're a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine. You lecture widely about sexuality all over the world. You have a private psychotherapy practice. But when you went off to Berkeley in the 1960s, you studied a very different aspect of
That's
reproduction.
For sure. Well, I went to Berkeley as a junior in college. I spent my first 2 years here in New York, and then I went to Berkeley. So I started working with rodent sexuality because I was under the impression, as were we all in the field, that there was this kind of big mammalian thing about sexuality. And mammals, we were all kind of variations on a theme. And that if you could see how the mechanisms worked in the rat, how the hormones affected the learning environment, affected the testing environment, sort of the psychobiology of the rat would tell you something about the psychobiology of the dog, of the monkey, of the camel, of the shark, of whatever, and of the human being. And we were all just one big, happy mammalian family. And so I kind of thought, well, that's interesting. And watching animals mate, that was mildly interesting. A little bit goes a long way. But still, you know, there are things to learn. So I did that at Berkeley and did my dissertation and went off to have a career.
Now, you got a PhD in the hormones and mating habits of the golden hamster.
Right. Mesocrisidus auratus, the golden hamster.
Is this something now, when you look back, you understand why you went this route? Or is it something you kind of think, oh, well, I wouldn't have done that now?
I wouldn't have done that now. Underscore, underscore. I mean, to me, the world changed, you know, in the 1970s with the women's movement. My head completely changed. This happened to so many of us, but, you know, each story is the story of a profound reconsideration of your whole life and of everything that you used to think and believe.
On Ideas, you're listening to sexologist and psychologist Leonore Tiefer talk about her favorite subject, sex. After a PhD in biological constructs of sex, Leonore Tiefer's intellectual world was turned upside down when she discovered feminism while teaching at Colorado State University. Leonore Tiefer, in conversation with Mary O'Connell.
So, you know, we're cooking along, 1970, 71, and then another woman joins the department. And this is the event I look back on, Pamela Pearson. She came from Chicago, and she was a lesbian. And I didn't know any lesbians, so she was a lesbian, so she had a girlfriend, so that was really interesting. And she said, "Do you know about the movement?" And I said, the movement. What movement? And she said, you know, the women's movement. There's speeches, there's marches, there's pamphlets. Mm. There's a revolution going on there, the Women's Liberation Movement, WLM. Huh. And I thought, oh, my God, gimme, gimme, gimme. So I started reading and reading and reading and reading. And I, oh, my God, that's me. Sexuality was a big topic back then. You are in charge of your body. You should know about your body. Get a speculum. Look at your cervix. I got involved in a consciousness-raising group, and we got some of these plastic speculums, and we looked at our cervixes. Then there were these papers like Ann Coate, K-O-E-D-T, you remember her?
No.
The Myth of the Vaginal Orgasm?
Yes, of course.
Right, that was a stunning paper. It was very energizing. There was a lot of work to do, and there was a lot being written about sex.
Now, Betty Dodson?
Dodson, yes.
Dodson, she was a big name then.
She's here in New York. She's in her late 70s and still absolutely a ball of fire. She had been a graphic artist. And in 1974, she published a pamphlet of her genital drawings. She'd been a graphic artist. She kind of became an erotic artist, drew a lot of nudes, and then got this idea to draw women's genitalia, partly for artistic purposes, because she thought women's genitalia was beautiful, like flowers, you know, an infinite variety, no two the same. And so let me draw them. So she wrote this booklet, and it was called Liberating Masturbation. And it was full of these drawings, and it was the story of how she learned to call it a meditation on self-love. And she started doing group workshops here in New York, and this pamphlet kind of described how women could learn about their bodies and their capacities for pleasure through masturbation. That was totally, totally revolutionary.
I mean, it doesn't seem like that would happen today, or it just seems almost improbable.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a brief thing, maybe in the middle 90s, you know, if AIDS sort of was discovered in 1981 or two or so, and people started really getting acquainted with the methods of transmission and so on in the late 80s, there were so many interesting things that happened in sexuality. And one of them was called sexual healing. There was a whole trend of sexual healing that was about outer course, a term you have probably never heard of. This term never took off. But the idea was that if AIDS was transmitted by the bodily fluids and penetration, if we could find activities that were safe but highly erotic, intensely pleasurable, that we could teach people these things and kind of shift the focus of sexual activity from penetration to outer course, both for men with men, women with women, men with women, everybody. And it would be much safer. And so outer course, of course, involved a lot of manual stimulation and group learning. So these sexual healing workshops did, in fact, involve group masturbation, but that came and went.
I mean, what would you, how would you describe how that has happened? that outer course didn't sort of take off, so to speak?
Well, I guess it's the same reason that I think Viagra did take off, that the culture, despite the tremendous commercial explosions of sexuality, is not really a sensual, pleasure-oriented sexual culture. And it was ahead of its time. Outer course is ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. That whole rhetoric of penetrative sex being real sex was still completely dominant, and there simply wasn't enough time and there wasn't the educational infrastructure. I mean, you never saw an article in the New York Times about outer course, mm-hmm. but you see endless articles in the New York Times about erectile dysfunction and fixing it with this, that, or the other drug. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that? Is somehow outer course, I think, is seen as just a little bit dirty. You know, it's a little bit prurient. It's a little bit too lubricious, whereas medicalized sex and functions of the body and this and that, as if the functions of sex were built in. They're not built in. Mm-hmm. Sex is anything you want it to be. It could be out of course. It could be in of course.
But perhaps maybe what is something needed, you think, that there should be declared a penetration-free week per year, where it is suggested strongly that they indulge in outer course.
You'll have to have an extremely macho male politician promote outer course week.
Well, we have a lot of those.
That'll be good, because otherwise it'll be seen as an anti-male, man-hating. You know, that's how a lot of things got delegitimized from the feminist point of view. We had all these great ideas. You know, let's have much more foreplay. You know, let's have less intercourse. Let's have more tenderness and touching and manual stimulation and not so much intercourse. And, oh, yeah, man-hating, man-hating. You know, it's all the same story. It's about the weird way that sex is dealt with in this culture. I mean, I'm an intellectual. That's why you've invited me to talk on ideas, right? I ought to be in academia. Mm-hmm. But there are no departments of sexology or sexuality studies in academia. The academic study of sexuality is embryonic. So after I decided that I couldn't do animal research anymore, mm-hmm. because I just didn't believe in the model, I still thought of myself as a sexologist. And I looked around, what were my options? Well, it seemed like the main option, either I could be like a high school sex educator, something mm-hmm. like that, which that in and of itself is, there's not too many jobs there, but at least there are some. Or maybe I could go into clinical work. And that appealed to me. You know, listening to people's stories and trying to be helpful, that seems like a good idea. So I re-specialized as a clinician. I got another degree. And then where am I going to get a job? Well, I got an opportunity to work in this urology department by word of mouth.
Now, you worked in the Center for Male Sexual Dysfunction in the Department of Urology at Beth Israel Medical Center in New
Actually,
York City.
Actually, yes. I worked in two urology departments, Beth Israel and Montefiore mm-hmm. Medical Center. So combined 13 years, yeah. Well,
now, we'd never witnessed on the social landscape, though, these kinds of male sexual dysfunction clinics before run by urologists. Why?
There were a few urologists who began to see that this might be a legitimate subspecialty, and they began opening these centers for male sexuality. Mm-hmm. And they began having urological meetings. And, you know, after years later, I went back and thought to myself, why? Why did they start then? Mm-hmm. And I discovered that two of the main ways that urologists had been making money had disappeared because of technological progress. You know, one of them was kidney stone surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the invention of this lithotripsy machine that used shock waves to break up kidney stones, so you didn't need to do surgery anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, almost overnight, kidney stone surgery became much, much less prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was non-cancerous surgery of the prostate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they used to do surgery for that. My father had that surgery in 1977. I remember that very well.
Mm.
But drugs were invented in the 1980s to shrink the prostate, so you didn't need to have surgery for a benign condition anymore. So urologists had kind of the rug pulled out from under them.
Mm.
This is how I understood it then in retrospect. And they began looking around. What else could they do?
It's very interesting you're saying this kind of confluence of events. Did the feminist movement itself have anything to do with these centers for male sexual dysfunction popping up, so to speak?
I don't think so.
Because, you know, that's part of the rap, in a sense. People say, well, you know, men started feeling much more insecure.
Oh, I see what
and,
you're saying.
And, you know, the reasons were women were saying, you know, I can make rules or demands of my own body. I don't have to just go along, right, sexually.
You know, it sounds good, and I might be tempted to go along with that, except that the men that I saw in the Beth Israel urology department and the men that I then saw at Montefiore when I moved to that other hospital were not the least bit influenced by this type of rhetoric, and their wives or girlfriends were not the feminist kind of people either.
Mm-hmm.
So while I do agree with you that the rules changed, I think you're right about there being a kind of atmosphere, but I wouldn't say it's of the women's movement. I think it's more of kind of capitalism looking for more and more markets,
mm-hmm.
you know, seeing everything as an opportunity for commercialization. You know, why are there so many urologists in the first place? You know, this is a larger question. Why aren't there more geriatricians? You know, that has to do with economic issues as much as gender issues or sexuality issues.
Right. So when you say once you create a center like this, the Male Center for Sexual Dysfunction, even if men do not attend this center, there is an atmosphere created.
Absolutely.
There are messages given, perhaps, that, oh, you know, that perhaps there's stress, anxiety that's created.
I totally think that that's what happened, that there was a lot of news about these centers. There was a lot of coverage of the new medical view of erections, endless stories about, oh, if only we had a drug. Wake up here. What's the matter with you? You may have a problem. Your partner may have a problem. And you might say, well, that's a good message because here are these suffering people who never had any encouragement. But I see the other side, which is that we're creating anxiety in people who were just getting along okay, or who were having outer course,
mm-hmm.
or other kinds of cuddling and intimacy, pleasure, and were not troubled about it. But now it is absolutely essential to one's self-esteem as an individual and to the couple's self-esteem. You know, we're not a real relationship. We're not having sex, people say nowadays. That didn't used to be true.
Tell me, Leonore, some of the stories from the days that you spent at this Center for Male Sexual Dysfunction. First of all, what went on there? What happened there?
Well, let's see. Patient would come in and would see the urologist first and would be kind of a conventional medical interview. You know, how do you do? What's your problem? And then the patient would be assigned to the workup. The workup sounds sort of like an off-Broadway play here.
Mm-hmm.
And the workup would consist of spending one or maybe even two nights in the sleep lab with their penis hooked up to a erection measuring device. And, you know, typically men have erections coincident with their rapid eye movement sleep phases. So maybe they have 5 or 6 erections during the night, even though they're unaware of these. And men come in, so they say, I'm not having erections, I'm impotent. And so, okay, the sleep lab might show that they were having erections at night. That meant that the equipment was working okay. And you'd show them this printout, and so that would be a part of the workup. Or they might not have erections at night. That was a little harder to interpret because they might not have slept well. I mean, how many people are going to sleep well in a strange lab with their penis hooked up to something and this technician watching them all night? But that would be part of the workup. Then there'd be a lot of blood work, even though we weren't entirely sure what we were looking for at that time. And then they would have an interview with me, and that would be the psychological. And I would sit down with these guys who, you know, 99.5% of them had never seen a psychologist before, and certainly not a woman who was going to ask them impertinent questions. I mean, so many guys would say to me, I've never told this to anyone before. You know, I had thought of needle pointing that, you know, putting it on a pillow in the waiting room so that they'd kind of get ready for the idea that they were going to talk about things they'd never talked about before to anyone. But yes, everyone started out self-conscious, but I like to think I put them at ease. That was a revolutionary experience because they would say, well, you know why I'm here. I don't have erections or I'm impotent. And I would say, as if I was like really stupid, I would say, uh-huh, and how is that a problem for you? Mm-hmm. How is that a problem? They would look at me like, no, I just told you. I don't have erections. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, and how is that a problem for you? Well, I would keep saying that until they would tell me more about the meaning that this experience had. Well, it means I can't have sex. I can't make love. I can't go near my wife. It means my wife's going to leave me. It means I don't feel like a man. It means I'm about to kill myself. It means, you know, my life is over, or whatever it meant. Uh-huh. It usually was pretty intense. Some guys, bless them to this day, would say, gee, you know, I never thought about that before. And I would say, well, most people haven't, so let's think about it together. You know, why is it important for you to have erections? And so then they would talk about, well, I like the feeling. I like to be inside my wife. I like to come that way. I like to ejaculate. Or my wife likes it. Or she says she likes the other stuff, the fingers, the mouth. She likes this and that. But she says, you know, it's a really special feeling when you're inside me. I miss that. So then, you know, I would get something about intimacy and something about gender and something about communication, and I would understand more. Sometimes guys would just clam up. I, you know, if you don't understand why it's a problem, lady, I can't tell you. That would happen from time to time. And I would, you know, I'd play with them. You know, I'd say, well, it's not that I don't understand. It's that every man is different. So just tell me why it's important for you.
But isn't that a huge hurdle that as a culture we, especially when it comes to sexuality, or I don't know if it's more intense with men than women, if there's a gender stratification here, that we want to be normal on the way it is?
Being normal is a big part of 20th century society. The word normal, you know, just a totally medicalized view of being good. You know, being good in other times and other places, being good consisted of other things, you know, killing the deer or praying to God or giving alms to the poor or whatever it was. But we don't talk so much here about being good nowadays. It's all about being normal, psycho good. And the assumption is that there is a sexual normal. I dispute this. I'm going to go down fighting on this one. I don't think there is such a thing. Of course, there's a statistical average. People say, well, I, doc, you know, I just want to be normal. okay, fine. What do you mean by normal? I had one guy answer this. Mm-hmm. He said, I just want to go into the bar and be able to sit on the stool with the other guys. Now, you may ask yourself, what on God's earth does that have to do with having erectile function?
Mm-hmm.
But it's this inner sense of masculinity that I'm a phony. If I can't get it up when I need to get it up, I'm a worthless man. And I can't go into a bar and hold my head up because they'll know. And even if they don't know, I'll know.
I can't even be in the company of other men.
Right.
The tribe.
That's right. It's like I give off some kind of aroma of fraudulence. This is terrible. This is spirit killing. This is soul destroying.
Mm-hmm.
See, I don't think this guy would have had trouble getting on the bar stool if he had erections once in a while 20 years ago.
Mm.
He would have at least felt okay.
Did you see differences? I mean, you told us really solid, you know, narrative here about what these men would say and mm-hmm. how they made sense of their lack of an erection and what it meant to them. Did you talk to their wives? Were they as stricken by this? What happened?
The wives were much more diverse. Some of them would say, the way the man said, I really miss intercourse. I liked it a lot. I could come that way, or whether I could or couldn't come that way. I liked the feeling. I felt close.
Mm-hmm.
But a surprising number of the women would not say that. They would say, I don't know what he is so hung up about here. I mean, this guy, if he wakes up in the morning and starts talking about his erectile failure and goes to bed at night, that's all I hear out of him. You think that he could give me a little massage? You think that he could hold me? You think he could learn how to do something other than just stick it in? So a lot of the women would be angry.
Hmm.
It was like he's going on and on about his pleasure, but not my pleasure. Or then there would be the ones who never asked. You know, and I would say, well, have you told him? And they would say, why should I tell him? He's supposed to know.
Mm-hmm.
People don't learn about their own bodies, how to communicate what they want, why they want it.
Mm-hmm.
They think they can turn it on just in a second. There's so many, quote, mistakes. It's not so easy to talk about things. Nowadays, communication is sort of more about a little slower, a little more to the left. Oh, that feels really good. You know, it's rarely about, you know, when we have a lot of tenderness and foreplay, I really feel like you care about me and I really feel respected and that makes me feel so close to you. Then I get really turned on and really hot. I mean, who produces a paragraph like that? You know, what do you see on something like Sex and the City? More about, so what do you like? Oh, I like blowjobs. Well, that's really informative.
In retrospect, Leonor, do you see a clear path from the 1980s when men could get maybe surgical rods implanted in their penis or give themselves an injection for an erection to the pill called Viagra today, the miracle cure, so to speak? Does it now seem like a clear path?
It seems like a clear path, but not without consideration of factors that you didn't mention, like the deregulation of the pharmaceutical industry. There were huge economic changes that happened in the 80s and the early 90s that made it profitable for companies to develop what they call lifestyle drugs. So the industry, because of advantages that they were given by legislative changes, made a pathway. So sex kind of was the poster child for forces that were going on independent of it. You can't boil it all down to a single thing. If I try, I'm going to sound like a jackass, and that would probably undermine all of the swell things I've already said. But, you know, we've had huge social changes and advertising out of control to make the body product to be sold and to create insecurity if you don't have the right kind, and to shrink the diversity. And people say to you, you know, well, you can be the best you can be. I mean, Oprah's famous line, you know, be the best you can be. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean I should get breast implants so I can be the best I can be?
And then perhaps maybe there's a certain sector of people who just say to heck with it and turn their backs on it because it seems to require so much effort.
Yes, I think they do, but they pay a price in self-esteem and in public face. They're ashamed. I know that's true. I talk to a lot of them. The sense of shame at not measuring up to a norm it's one of the fundamental social structures. Unless they have another rhetorical place to stand. The way I have another place to stand, I stand on feminism. Mm-hmm. That gives me a rhetoric. It gives me an attitude. It gives me self-confidence. It gives me an explanation so that I can resist the blandishments of People magazine. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't have that. You know, we're minds and we're bodies, and it's so erotic to be with someone else's mind and to feel the comfort, the pleasure, and the acceptance that comes from somebody seeing your naked reality and kissing it all over. But if you've had all of these surgical things done and you've taken 3 drugs and you're experiencing the side effects and you're wondering how long it's going to last, are you really going to relax and feel your body being worshipped by somebody else?
Well, you may not even feel like it is your body anymore.
Yeah. You know, to me, it's making love. There I go, giving away my 1960s orientation. It's about making love, not having sex.
Perhaps it would be enlightening or at least relaxing or liberating to not have as a focus, you know, orgasm and the aftermath, but just kind of playing.
Yes.
And maybe even failing to have an orgasm, but not calling it failing, but just not having one.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because we haven't talked enough about orgasm. I think that the central focus on orgasm is a colossal mistake. Mm-hmm. And that this is one of the ways that the culture betrays the potential of sex, I think. I think orgasm has become such a focus because you can count it. It's a score. It happened. If you have it, you're a success. Mm-hmm. But I came of age before orgasm mattered to many women. Petting was really popular, necking and petting, and not to orgasm in my experience. I've talked to other women my age who say it was different from them, so let me not generalize here. Mm-hmm. But I know it is possible to spend years feeling really sexy, really turned on, enjoying myself thoroughly, never having intercourse, never having an orgasm, as I didn't know about them. And I wasn't missing them because I wasn't told that I wasn't doing the right thing. Like, I feel like, you know, some Native American wise woman, you know, telling a tale from 6,000 years ago. I think the orgasm, which is, what, a 10-second long thing, 12-second long thing, to work for hours to get the 12-second long thing, don't you think that's a little stupid? Couldn't we, like, spend time with whole body pleasure? I don't know how I could feel more strongly about it. I mean, I'm jumping up and down in this chair right now, but you can't see me waving my arms wildly. I think that we are creating an epidemic of insecurity about the body, and sex is one of the manifestations. So, I mean, I think we're all dreadfully insecure in this sort of lacking of community way, and we have to find our way to a new model of how to be with each other in relationship and in community, in larger community, and sex is a piece of that story.
Tell me, we only have a couple of minutes left, Leonore, tell me about a campaign that's close to your heart and that you've dedicated a website to.
Yes. Well, you know, so here I am thinking all of these revolutionary things and working in the urology department, and I can see that the way urologists and the medical model in general are dealing with sex is I think, a disaster. So when Viagra comes out, it's like, oh my God, this is what I've been worrying about all these years. This is the medicalization. This is the pursuit of perfection in a very narrow way. And then they started saying, and where's the Viagra for women? And I just hit the ceiling. I thought to myself, who wants a Viagra for women? Who said that women should have a Viagra? Who said this would make a better world? How can we have so many sex drugs and no mandatory comprehensive sex education? If people are going to be sexuality consumers, then they need to know something about the subject, or else they're going to be sheep, just led to the pharmacy counter. So I started a campaign. I got some people together. We started a website. We wrote some books. We wrote a training manual. We've had conferences. We've testified at the FDA.
The Food and Drug Administration.
Right. Mm-hmm. When they had dealt with their first drug for female sexual dysfunction, a completely new concept that was invented to sound like erectile dysfunction. You know, so we've got Viagra. And where's the Viagra for women? Wait a minute. What is the Viagra for women for? Uh-oh, we need a disease. All right, so men have erectile dysfunction. What do women have? Well, as we've been talking about, women have a lot of complaints here. Well, let's just say female sexual dysfunction, and we won't be too specific about what that is. So when the first drug came up, it was said to be a drug for, listen to this one, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, hypoactive sexual desire disorder. That means you don't have enough sexual desire. The industry is then going to flood the airwaves and the print media with advertisements, so everybody will then think, oh, well, you know, I could use a little boost here. Who couldn't use a little boost? And all kinds of unintended negative consequences will flow forth. This more subtle shift of the meaning of sex and the purpose of sex, and do I feel okay about me, my body, my lust, my libido, my pleasure? Do I feel okay about that, or do I need to work on it?
Tell us the name of your website.
Right. newviewcampaign.org, newviewcampaign.org, New View Campaign.
Right.
There's going to be drugs. There's going to be lots of drugs. How are we going to deal with them? That's the question. I'm energized by the fact that this is really important to me and that I think I'm making a persuasive case. And we'll see how it all turns out.
The Ideas of Leonor Tiefer was produced by Mary O'Connell. Technical production, Dave Field. Associate producer, Liz Nagy. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. To learn more about CBC Radio podcasts, please visit cbc.ca/podcasting.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC Radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.